From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Woodrow Wilson is often ranked as one of the country's greatest presidents, led the nation in World War I, envisioned the League of Nations, and making the world safe for democracy. He was also pretty clearly racist, and he acted on that racism. Should his name come down at Princeton University, where he was once also president? All over the country, big questions are being asked on campuses about culture and history and renaming away from racists. This hour on Point, race, history, and Woodrow Wilson, and what names should stand or go on American campuses. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Should Princeton remove Woodrow Wilson's name from the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs and more? Is that the way to handle hard history? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Later in this hour, after yesterday's firing of its police superintendent, we will hear the latest from Chicago. But first, to Woodrow Wilson and Princeton. Last month, a group of Princeton students began a sit-in at the university president's office, urging, among other things, the administration to rename the School of International Affairs. Here's one student speaking directly to the president of the university during the sit-in.
For you to tell me that it is okay to have Woodrow Wilson's name plastered across buildings, to idolize him, to see him as a god on this campus, that is disgusting, because as a black person, I am reminded of our second-class citizenship and how we are yet to be seen as humans in these spaces.
Opinion is by no means monolithic. There's a group called Open Campus Coalition wants to keep Woodrow Wilson's name on the School of Public and International Affairs. Here are two members, students Evan Dream and Josh Freeman, appearing last month on CBS News.
Woodrow Wilson had these racist attitudes, and we should definitely condemn him for that. However, we should also remember that historical figures are creatures of the times in which they live.
We have to respect the good and the bad when it comes to Woodrow Wilson. He's a part of this campus's history, and erasing it will not do us any favors.
Listeners, we want to hear from you, 800-423-8255, and we want to take this to a couple of historians very, very familiar with Princeton University. Joining me now from Princeton is Joshua Guild, Professor of History and African-American Studies at Princeton. Joshua Guild, Professor Guild, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
And from Princeton, Julian Zelizer joins us, Professor of History at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton. Fellow at the New American Foundation, his recent book was The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress and the Battle for the Great Society. Julian Zelizer, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
So maybe the first thing to do, perhaps Professor Guild, Joshua Guild, you could help us lay out the sort of plus and minus column for Woodrow Wilson. As a historian, what are his big pluses? And when it comes to race in particular, what are the minuses? What are people focused on?
Sure. I mean, of course, this is a part of a larger protest movement, not only at Princeton, but nationwide, as you indicate. And the question around Wilson is one of several student demands that we ought to, you know, also have a chance to talk about maybe a little bit later. But as far as Wilson himself, I mean, of course, he's revered on this campus as being an alumnus of the university and a former university president who helped to modernize the university and modernize higher education in the United States more generally. As president, and as my colleague Julian can discuss further, he was an architect of modern liberalism in many ways, and helping to initiate a whole host of regulatory agencies and mechanisms on the domestic side, but also in the international sphere. He's best known as the driving force behind the vision for the League of Nations, which, of course, predated the United Nations.
On the racist side, there are associations with the KKK that come up. He didn't think black students should be at Princeton, and they weren't when he was president there. And the charge is that he purged the federal government of African-American employees, or knocked them way down the ladder there after they had struggled up out of the Reconstruction era to get a foot on the American ladder. What are the facts there?
Well, sure. I mean, there are sort of two intertwined things at play here. One, of course, is Wilson's own personal views, his views about African Americans and other non-white people. And I think that is sort of neither here nor there to a degree. And as one of the students in the opening suggested, he is a person of his time. He's a Southerner. He's born in Virginia. He grows up in a moment in which Jim Crow is the law of the land, is the dominant ideology in America. But that said, as a university administrator, as the president here at Princeton, and then later as the president of the United States, he actively pursued policies of segregation. He actively pursued policies meant to exclude non-white peoples from in various different ways. As you noted, while he was president, he discouraged the applications of prospective black applicants. They would write to him. There's several instances here that we have in the archives of Wilson saying, writing back to potential applicants to say, you would not be welcome here at this campus early in the 20th century. As president, he helped to segregate and expunge African Americans from the federal bureaucracy, where they were starting to make inroads after Reconstruction. He hosted, very famously, the showing of the D.W. Griffith film, A Birth of a Nation, which celebrated the downfall of Reconstruction and the rise of the Democratic Party and the Ku Klux Klan as a kind of mechanism of white supremacy. He hosted a showing of that film at the White House.
He spoke, did he not, and wrote favorably about the KKK and its role in his textbook, History of the American People, talked about the efforts, and I think KKK involved, to free the South from, quoting Wilson here, the incubus of that ignorant and often hostile black vote.
Yes, I mean, it's quite unambiguous. I mean, so, we can certainly talk about his views again and his policies. We should also note that there's an international dimension to this. He's helped to oversee the occupation of Haiti in 1915 and generally viewed African, Asian, Arab people as incapable of self-government in the international arena. So even as we're talking about his accomplishments as a diplomat, we can't separate that from some views as well that saw certain peoples of the world capable of government, capable of independence, and others not.
So I want to take this to Julian Zelizer, but let me just get you on the record first, Professor Guild. As a professor of history there at Princeton, as an African-American yourself, looking at this figure and looking at the new demands, and as you say, they're not just there. I mean, look across the country, University of Missouri and Yale and Purdue and Amherst and Alabama and Kansas and Emory and Georgetown. I mean, there are questions being raised all over the place, but Princeton is sort of first and foremost here. Do you think that, and it's not just the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs, it's also the big residential complex there, Wilson College. Do you think the name should come down?
I'm really heartened that we're having this conversation. I'm heartened that these students, undergraduate students by and large, have forced open a conversation that has really not ever taken place in public on this campus in the more than 2.5 centuries of its existence, or certainly since the time of Wilson. And I think that's really important. So I'm really excited about the process that the university has formally undertaken. The Board of Trustees is initiating a committee to look at Wilson's role. There'll be a kind of public dialogue that we've never had. Where that comes out, I'm not sure. But I think it's really important for Princeton. It's really important for the nation to have this kind of direct and, I hope, nuanced confrontation with really difficult aspects of our history.
Julian Zelizer, professor of history at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs there at Princeton. There's a lot I want to ask you, but first, do you see this as a serious question at Princeton right now? Is the Board of Trustees taking this demand seriously? Might the name come down?
Well, I think they are. I mean, I think if we take everything at face value, the president is certainly putting together a committee and asking historians their advice and insights. And I think this is a genuine response to the students. And certainly many faculty feel that way. I think a lot of faculty won't have a clear answer about what to do, which is fine. But I think what a lot of faculty agree on is the need for this debate, not just with the Wilson School, but I think the kind of broad range of issues that the students have raised here and at other campuses, from Yale to the University of Mississippi. We need to have this debate. And I'll say one other thing. I think many faculty are heartened to see student activism. This is a period many people say students are not engaged enough. And so they have now triggered a national debate about race relations. And it's taking place through Woodrow Wilson, but I think in many ways it's much broader than that. But I do think there's a serious look at this, and I don't know how this will end.
How do you, as a historian, look at the weight of Woodrow Wilson's racism?
Well, it's clearly a part of who he was, a big part of who he was. And I don't think there's a debate about that. I think the debate about the school has now brought this to people's attention. This was part of American liberalism during this period. All the liberal presidents suffered from aspects of this, including Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson, who helps push through the Civil Rights Act of 1964. You know, the questions that are raised is – not so much just was he part of the times, because I think it's much more than that. He was proactively, you know, supporting policies of racial segregation. But it's A, you know, kind of how do you make these determinations with many buildings and many programs that are named after people with a less than favorable record on issues from race to gender to homophobia. And two, you know, there is this aspect of Wilson. There was another part of him where he is the architect of liberalism, one of them. And, you know, because of his administration, we ended up with a federal government that was much more sizable than we had before. And I do think that was important for many of the advances, the progressive advances of the century. So I think it's raised a lot of hard questions about how you deal with these historical figures. But there's no denying the racial element of his personhood and his presidency.
In half a minute, we'll come back to this in more detail. But as a historian, is this a legitimate debate to your eyes, or are you in the camp that says, look, everyone is a creature of their times. Times change. If we go back and apply our standards now, back in history, nothing makes sense. Is this a legitimate debate to have over the name?
It's a legitimate debate. If we name buildings to honor people, we can raise questions about why we're doing that and if it should be done.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the campus debate over renaming buildings named for people tied in history to racism. Our focus today, Woodrow Wilson, former president of the United States. Princeton students, he was also president there, some of them, want him, his name, gone. Later in this hour, we'll look at the latest out of Chicago, where the police chief has been fired. We have two Princeton historians with us today, Joshua Guild and Julian Zelizer. It has been hot on the Princeton campus. Here was the sound of students last month outside the office of the Princeton president.
No justice! No peace! No justice! No peace! No justice!
One of those students talking here to Vice News about what she finds so offensive about the former president.
He was an overtly racist person, and he has a connection. He had a connection to the Ku Klux Klan, right? So he has contributed to the slow yet very present genocide of black people in this country.
There's not unanimity. Here's another Princeton student, Dan Taub, talking with Vice News.
Where I really strongly disagree is that the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs should be renamed, because the idea of legacy is really important to me. So Woodrow Wilson may have been a racist, and we should acknowledge that as an institution. But we should also acknowledge that he created a normative structure for international relations that has led to the United Nations.
You can join us. Is acknowledging the flaws in our past enough, or do we actually have to rename? The Board of Trustees at Princeton is actively on this. Right now, Joshua Guild and Julian Zelizer are there in Princeton, New Jersey. Lots of calls for the two of you. Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
You know what? Absolutely, I think the name should be taken down. And not only that, I think we should go even further. We rightfully so, and the world rightfully so, really destroy Adolf Hitler for killing people, for what he did. But at the same time, Adolf Hitler didn't own human beings. George Washington did.
So would you name? Would you rename Washington, D.C.? Is that where we're headed, Carl?
We should be mature enough to say, you know what? George Washington was probably one of the biggest figures in American history, but also be mature enough to say that you own human beings. And the argument that people use, well, where they were people of their time, no, human decency is timeless. So just because you were in that time period, you didn't have to participate in that, but they did.
Would you rename Washington, D.C.? What would you call it?
Let's call it King D.C. You know, there's a lot of great Americans that the city, that our capital could be named. Think about that. Our capital is named after a human being who owned other human beings.
Carl, we've got it. Down with Wilson, down Washington for that matter. Let me get one more right here, and I'll go to our historians, Alexander in Boston. Thank you for calling, Alexander. You're on the air.
How are you?
I'm okay. What do you think?
Well, I can tell you, as a retired clergyman, a lot of stuff in the Bible that induces violence and so on, but to erase that, just because we don't like it, to make ourselves feel good, erases the evidence of the thing we're objecting to. So I think you have to be very careful when going about rewriting history and removing names. And I don't agree with Wilson's attitude about African Americans at all. I think it's despicable. So one has to have a nuanced attitude. And as far as that goes, when they're taking pot shots at people, as they did with some people did with Alexander Hamilton, they said he was a slaveholder. He never was. So you have to get your facts right. They wanted to rename Leechmere Station because Mr. Leechmere, a loyalist, inherited a slave from his sister. But they dig a little farther, and he immediately freed the slave and set him up in his own business. But, so what about Charles River? Same after King Charles I.
So own the history. Washington stick Street. With the history even as we, explicate and understand it. I'll take that to our historians. Alexander, I appreciate your call. I mean, lots have been written on this. Karen Atia is at the Washington Post, and she wrote, Black students, she was talking about the United States today, American campuses, about Woodrow Wilson, about Cecil Rhodes and South Africa. She wrote, Black students across the globe are forcing universities to go beyond simplistic notions of diversity as a panacea to address racial injustices, past and present. The protests, she wrote, against Woodrow Wilson and Cecil Rhodes are not about diversity. These protests are about dismantling white supremacy. These protests are about decolonization. As if she suggests there, that is still a challenge to achieve. Joshua Gall, as an historian, we understand you say you're glad that this conversation is on. You're glad for the light that will be cast here, but a decision's going to have to be made. How do you feel in principle about the idea of taking honors away from people, in Wilson's case, a century ago for his attitudes then, stripping it off a building today? As a historian, what do you think of that as a way of reworking our understanding?
I mean, I absolutely understand that this presents itself as a kind of slippery slope, and I think that's fair. I mean, in fact, the Woodrow Wilson School sits on Washington Road, which is one of the main thoroughfares here
and
in
on
Princeton,
we go.
And on we go, right? So you know, we can understand that. So without, you know, so proposing a kind of blanket standard, yes, this should happen in all instances or only, you know, in a particular instance. The question to me is one of about values. What are our values? You know, who do we venerate in our public spaces and in our institutions and in our society? And what does that say about who we are? You know, symbols actually matter. I mean, there's one of the critiques here of this demand or this movement is that this is purely symbolic. But in fact, I think symbols really matter again as a reflection of our values. One of the students quoted earlier in the piece, talked about acknowledging the history. But I think we have to really ask, what do we mean when we say acknowledge? You know, this has to be more than just a footnote, right? So let's suppose that we leave Wilson's name intact here at Princeton. And, there's some kind of acknowledgement. It has to be more than just a passing note, right? I mean, it has to be a real direct confrontation with that history. And I think there has to be at least some kind of memorialization of
like what? Pin a note on the bulletin board saying racism lived here or what?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, that's what I don't want to see. It's mm-hmm. simply, some small little plaque, some little modest gesture that makes us feel good that we've acknowledged something. And then we sort of move on to business as usual. What some African-American students and other students are saying is that it actually is painful to proceed on this campus and to proceed in other spaces where somebody who not just has, again, these kind of personally abhorrent views, but pursued these active policies mm-hmm. of segregation and white supremacy, is held up in such esteem with no kind of acknowledgement, substantive acknowledgement of that fact.
So if it were going to be acted upon, on your advice to the Board of Trustees, what would you recommend? Take the name down?
I would recommend the Paul Robeson School of Public and International Affairs.
Paul Robeson, the actor, social activist, singer.
Yes, and native son of Princeton, New Jersey, who advocated for anti-colonialism and human rights around the world. And I think that would send a real message about what Princeton stands for. And yes, it's a repudiation of Wilson. It's not erasing history. It doesn't remove him from the annals of Princeton or from the United States. And we can still grapple with the complexity of his imprint. But I think it would, you know, as we look around this campus and many other campuses, the absolute dearth of symbols celebrating non-white people, frankly, I think that would be a really powerful gesture.
The Paul Robeson School of Public and International Affairs. You heard it here, and you may hear it again. Julian Zelizer, how about you first on principle? I mean, reading here again from Karen Attia in the Washington Post, she says students, and again, this is not only at Princeton, many campuses across the country, students are fundamentally challenging symbols of anti-blackness on their campuses, she writes. The protests and demands are forcing universities to reckon with their roles in perpetuating racism in no small part through the whitewashed reverence of historical leaders whose racist political legacies still haunt our societies today. This is a good thing, she writes. So we put it to you in principle, Julian. Do you think, as a historian, does it make sense to go back and strip down names?
I think there is certainly a legitimate argument to make about this, and I understand it. I do think it brings up difficult questions. One is how broad do you go on this? So, you know, I was just in Washington the other day and I walked by the Russell Building, named after Richard Russell, the senator who filibustered civil rights. Mm-hmm. And I can see many names that we need to examine if we go this route. We might end up like MIT with numerical buildings. And so I think it's legitimate. That's not to raise questions about the demand, but to think through how will we do this. And it's also we'll have to go in addition to race to other areas that concern students. There's a long history of sexism and gender discrimination among many of our leaders, and that certainly has to be brought up. Anti-Semitism, homophobia. We have to deal with a broad range of issues if we do this. I think that's important. But symbols do matter, and I just hope that that doesn't become the sole focus of the debate. I think what really moves me about the students is they have raised a number of issues that touch on institutional racism in educational institutions, in our civic life that have to be dealt with. And so the name I don't have an answer for, but I do hope we can address this in the curriculum, in the student organizations and activities that we offer, that this conversation doesn't end after the decision is made on the building.
It is kind of amazing. I mean, you saw everything that happened in Ferguson, and here we are. These still just months, I mean, more than a year, but it is not forever afterward. And things are being challenged and discussed that are a little bit hard to imagine not very long ago. Let's go to Princeton, Illinois, and Adina. Adina, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, thank you. I kind of had a little bit of a question or a comment, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little bit curious as to why people are so convinced that if we were to rename this building and this school, why do people seem to believe that it would completely erase Woodrow Wilson? Like, we could absolutely rename the school, and we could put as a historical note even with that moment that we renamed it because of these issues, that it was renamed, that it was named after Woodrow Wilson originally, and it was renamed because of these issues.
Adina, are you suggesting go ahead, rename it, it's no problem, or are you just doubting that it will erase? I mean, no one's saying erase him from history. They're saying don't honor him.
And that's what I'm saying. I'm confused as to why people would think that if we were to rename it, it would erase him.
No.
I seem to hear a lot of people kind of feeling that way.
Do you think it should be renamed or not? I'm trying to pin you down. Rename?
I think that it certainly could be. Yes, let's go with that.
Okay, and Wilson would still be there, and that's quite true, but he wouldn't be honored in the same way. Let me hold that and go to Avon, Connecticut. Jan, you're on.
Hi. I think racism is the most destructive, demonic mentality that has existed and exists today. I think the damage it has done has been beyond comprehension. I do not feel there is a decent person who is racist, and historic period is no excuse, and I think a racist name should be buried, should be removed and gone. I will hang up, and I thank you.
Jen, we've got it. Well, it is certainly on the docket at Princeton, and there are other challenges being raised at other campuses around the country. We're talking about all of it. Let me go to Carol in Salem, Massachusetts. Carol, you are on. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Yes, I'm sorry. I can barely hear because there's music in the background. But my comment is that as a black woman, while I understand the historical context of what some of these historical figures, the involvement and their justification and aspiring to racist attitudes, but at the same time, I don't believe a name should be changed. I think that the students and faculty and all of us as citizens should redirect our energy towards, you know, making sure that the topic of white privilege and racism, the impact of racism on the society, should be at the forefront. I don't want to get lost in a name. I want institutions of all kinds to start mandating the study of white privilege and racism. I think we need to really make those goals and change policies and procedures and not get hung up on names.
Carol, I appreciate your call. Joshua Guild, what are the best arguments that you've heard for and against changing this name?
Well, just to piggyback quickly on the last caller's comment, mm-hmm. In fact, one of the demands of the students alongside the removal of Wilson's name is, as my colleague Julian indicated a few moments ago, are a set of demands related to cultural competency. I mean, they want to have a curricular requirement that all students at Princeton take a course or set of courses in the history of marginalized people nationally and internationally that could include mm-hmm. African-American history, but not only. Mm-hmm. There's a way in which I think these students are calling for something much more than, again, just this name. It's a grappling with the history here at Princeton. I mean, our colleague Martha Sandweiss has a piece in The Nation this week, and she's also a historian here and has been undertaking over a series of years a study of Princeton's relationship to the institution of slavery. And many people on this campus are unaware that slaves were present here at Princeton from the outset, that slaves were sold in what is now the Alumni House of Princeton. And that's something that this institution has not really fully grappled with yet. And so I think the students who are leading this protest movement, the members of the Black Justice League and their allies, are pushing for a much bigger conversation and something much more along the lines of what your caller was calling for.
Julian Zelizer, in a nutshell, the best arguments you've heard for and against. We've got about a minute here.
The best argument is it's hurtful to some students and it creates an environment for some of our student body that is difficult. The best arguments against is this is a very difficult judgment to make. Wilson stands for many things besides this, including many progressive ideas, and that in the end, the best way to address this is not to change names, but rather to change the curriculum, to change the kind of faculty research we're doing, to devote an even greater part of the school to dealing with matters of race. And so that's the best argument against.
Is this change possible in your view? Is it possible in a couple of years we'll see the Paul Robeson School instead of the Woodrow Wilson School?
Well, I don't know about the name, but I think the other changes are totally feasible. Universities devote resources to all sorts of issues. Princeton has done this with African American studies, and so it's more about doubling down and maybe within the Wilson School itself devoting more attention to the issues of race relations and racial justice.
It's an issue at Princeton University and at campuses many right across this country. Julian Zelizer, professor of history at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Joshua Guild, you will recognize Paul Robeson behind us right here. Maybe that will be the name one day. Professor of History and African American Studies at Princeton. Professor Guild, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Listeners, there's so much going on in Chicago. We are going to go to Chicago after a short break and look at it. The police superintendent is out. The heat is rising on Mayor Rahm Emanuel himself after a killing and charges of cover-up. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is sponsored by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses, made in America. They're engineered for comfort and long-lasting support, with just the right sink, just the right bounce. Two technologies, latex foam and memory foam, come together for better nights and brighter days. It's outrageous comfort at a polite price. Here's the great part. You can try one risk-free for 100 days with free delivery and returns. Go to casper.com/onpoint. That's casper.com/onpoint. And remember to use promo code ONPOINT at checkout to receive a special offer. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Laquan McDonald was killed by a Chicago police officer in October 2014. 16 shots at a young man walking away, lying on the ground, all caught on dash cam video that was suppressed for more than a year. Last week saw murder charges against Officer Jason Van Dyke, the release of the video, and protesters taking to the streets of Chicago. You can hear some of that behind me right now. Yesterday, Mayor Rahm Emanuel fired the police superintendent. We're going to look at what's going on in Chicago today. You can join us on air or online. What do you see unfolding in Chicago? On Monday, the lawyer for Laquan McDonald's family, Jeff Nussland, spoke to CNN.
You cannot justify this shooting. The idea or suggestion that my client was threatening anyone from 12, 15 feet away is ridiculous. And then once he's on the ground and he is shot repeatedly, that's nothing but first-degree murder, in my opinion.
And yesterday, after rising tension over what went on with that video for all that time, why it took so long for this to become public, and more, Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel announced that he had fired Chicago Police Superintendent Gary McCarthy.
Superintendent McCarthy and I began a discussion on Sunday about the direction of the department and the undeniable fact that the public trust in the leadership of the department has been shaken and eroded. This morning, I formally asked for his resignation.
And he got it. Joining us now from Chicago is Hal Dardick, reporter for the Chicago Tribune, covering politics, government, budgets, and City Hall. Hal, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Also with us from Chicago is Malcolm London, poet and activist. He was arrested in the protest last week. All charges subsequently dropped. Malcolm London, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. Hal Dardick, first to you as our reporter here. Where do things stand right now? It's all done with Gary McCarthy. He's out. And what's next?
The mayor said yesterday that he's forming a task force that's going to look into how to deal with police officers who have a lot of misconduct complaints filed against them and to weed them out earlier before their behavior escalates to a point like it did in the case of Officer Van Dyke and Laquan McDonald. They're also going to look at when to release video tapes, even if there's an investigation going on, and other better ways to discipline officers and weed out rogue cops.
We've seen some of that video. How much more is there that still hasn't been shown to the public?
Well, we got a hold of at the Chicago Tribune four other dash cam videos, and they don't necessarily show the incident itself, but they do show other officers arriving at the scene and them following this young man as they were trying to get him to drop a 3-inch knife. And what's interesting about those videos is that they don't have any sound on them. And this may not be the only video that's out there. Yesterday, we did a story about another shooting took place 8 days before this one, shot a 25-year-old man in the back. His lawyer claims that when we see that video, it will show that he, too, wasn't being aggressive with officers, as was the case with Laquan McDonald.
Hal, one more question. I want to go to Malcolm here, but Rahm Emanuel's administration has said that the motivation behind keeping this dash cam video out of the public eye in this case was to preserve the integrity of this ongoing criminal investigation. But I see Politico reporting today that the Cook County Prosecutor's Office is saying it never insisted on pursuing a legal fight that kept the video out of public view. That turns the eye of the world back on Rahm Emanuel. Is his job at risk here?
I think there have certainly been a lot of calls for his resignation from the protesters involved in this. The Black Lives Matter movement have called for his resignation. It would be really startling if the mayor were to resign, or if anyone were to be able to remove him from office. The thresholds to do that in the state of Illinois are incredibly high. I don't see that happening. But something else is going to have to give here, and you have to take with a grain of salt what comes out of the state attorney's office, because there's a lot of pressure on her to resign. Why did it take her 13 months to bring murder charges against this police officer in this case, when this video, at least on its face, seems to show what looks like an assassination? There's going to be a lot of developments, though, what I find startling is there's an amazing amount of pressure on this mayor with such a high profile, who, especially in the media in other cities, was sort of seen as something of an icon, and now there's a lot of people questioning his judgment.
Cook County State's Attorney Anita Alvarez, also in the hot seat here. Malcolm London, we've talked with you about culture and race and poetry. You're also an activist. You were right out there. I mean, the accusation was that you had punched a cop. I guess all that's gone away. What is really going on here, Malcolm?
Yeah, well, first of all, I did not punch a cop. And I think what is happening with Rahm Emanuel, I mean, the larger question for a lot of folks is beyond this case, right? I think all folks were sort of in cahoots in the ways in which this tape was released, and how soon and how quickly the mayor's office, the superintendent, and Anita Alvarez all responded in a way that, was tried to make this into a political opportunity. When really they all knew about this tape a year ago.
The mayor was running for re-election
while he was sitting on this tape. And so what does that say about a mayor who was at the same time parading around Black neighborhoods, while at the same time, even before the tape, had closed schools in these neighborhoods, but it's talking about that he cares about these people. And so I think for a lot of people, and a lot of organizers at least, it was very clear that this was more about a political opportunity to say, well, hey, look, I'm actually doing what people are saying, but you sat on this for a year. The police are deleting footage from Burger King. Everyone is at fault here who is in a position of power that let this get away from them.
Does it look like a deliberate cover-up? I mean, they went into the Burger King next to where Laquan was shot, spent hours in there. The suggestion is that there's, 80 missing minutes now, that they took those away. It could look like an active cover-up.
The word from City Hall is that there was something wrong with that surveillance system at that Burger King.
Who buys that? The Burger King people say it never failed before the cops came in that day.
Well, I'm just telling you what they're saying over at City Hall. They're trying to defend this. There is a lot of evidence that we know about at this juncture. And, of course, the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office is looking into this matter. But there's a lot of evidence that shows there was a concerted effort, or at least could suggest that there was a concerted effort to not let all of the evidence out in this case. The other thing is the videotape of the shooting doesn't have on the tape the sound from inside the squad car, so we don't know what these officers were saying. And why wasn't that sound on? It should have been on. It should have been on those four other tapes that we got a hold of. Was not on those four tapes. And there's also allegations that there were several witnesses on the street, citizens who were there that day, and that they were shooed away and not even interviewed. We have talked to some of those folks at the Tribune, and in their minds, what they saw was an execution. So there's just so many questions swirling around this. The state indictment of the officer is just the beginning. We'll have to see what the federal investigation brings and whether there's any charges of conspiracy in this case.
Big questions, big trouble in Chicago. We've got callers from around the country for the two of you, Hal Dardick and Malcolm London. Cliff in Charleston, South Carolina. Thank you for calling, Cliff. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Your previous speaker answered or spoke to one of my comments, the fact that Rahm Emanuel, while running for office, was sitting on this tape. I'm a lifelong resident of Chicago. I was born and raised there. I was on the west side of Chicago.
Were you shocked by what you saw in the video then, Cliff, or not?
No, I am not, because I've witnessed it myself. Personally, growing up on the west side of Chicago, the police have a long history of violence against the black community. I'm 63 years old, and I have witnessed personally police on many occasions beating, getting no good reason whatsoever. And this is before, obviously, video phones and surveillance cameras. I'm talking 50s, 60s.
Yep.
And they used to do this as a normal course of whatever they decided to do. And because they knew, first of all, that they would have no repercussions, and secondly, that the community was basically helpless.
I mean, you say used to, but this was just 1 year ago. That's not so far in the past. Cliff, I got a lot of callers here, but we got your witness that you grew up seeing this in Chicago. Let me go to Detroit. Cliff, thank you. Bruce in Detroit, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay. What do you know?
I'm a native Detroiter. I'm 70 years old, and what you're making reference to is something that's historic here in Detroit. Recently, we've had situations where police brutality has come to the forefront in terms of dealing with everyday citizens. And the thing I think needs to be done to curtail this is to have a psychological test on each officer before they put on that badge, and also to have it done at intervals to make sure that this person is psychologically sound. Now, to sit and say that this is all a racist agenda, yes, I think so in a lot of instances. We have police precincts here who routinely take people in, they come out beat up the whole nine yards, and nobody does anything about it. So what happened in Chicago does not surprise me at all.
Bruce, we've got it from Detroit, and I'll take it to my guest. I appreciate your call. We're talking about the trouble in Chicago right now. One more call, and I'll go back to Malcolm London and Hal Dardick. Sandy in Woodstock, Illinois. Sandy, you're on.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'm calling. I do believe Rahm Emanuel squashed that. I mean, that just seems to be what kind of political person he is. Until his election was granted, he broke is trying to break the teachers' union. Pretty much a Republican underneath Democrat clothing. But in the defense of the police department in Chicago, I know a couple of policemen. They are outgunned, outmanned, understaffed. They're dealing with violent gangs and hiring people who come from Afghanistan, get their MP training in the service or Iraq.
Yep.
And when they finally do have to pull their gun and shoot, I think sometimes they just can't stop.
Sandy, we've got it. And there's a kind of wisdom there, too. I want to take it to Hal and Malcolm. Malcolm, first to you. The police superintendent is fired. Is that enough? Or what is it going to take to set things right here?
Yeah, no, I don't think it's enough. And even to the last caller, I think the bigger question here is not about Rahm Emanuel. It's not about Nydia Alvarez. It's not about Gary McCarthy. It's about the larger system of policing. From the two callers previous to the caller before, is that we know that policing in America in general is brutal, particularly in Chicago. We're talking about a city that gave away $500 million. In police abuse cases and police misconduct. What does that say about a city that claims there is no budget? We need to
You're talking
really
about settlements there made in the last decade or so in a quite amazingly short time.
Yeah. And that is horrific. What does it say about the policing culture? I am absolutely sure there's probably great one individuals on the police department. But what does it say about our policing culture? The guy, Jason Van Dyke, who is a murderer, who needs to be charged and convicted for first-degree murder, is and did already have $300,000 worth of complaints on his own as an officer, that we are not doing a great job.
But Malcolm, let me ask you, what about Sandy's point? Sandy's saying, look, the police in Chicago are outgunned by gangs and more. They're outmanned, understaffed. You've got Laura Washington at the Chicago Tribune columnist there saying, look, the black community, too, has to step up here and help get a grip on what's going on. Police alone can't do it.
The black community is not responsible for the poverty on the west and south side of Chicago. The black community is not responsible for the schools being closed and the mental health facilities that have been closed for the past decade by Rahm Emanuel either.
Hal, what do you see materially happening here? Where is this headed?
I think that the mayor's in for a very tough stretch here, and he's going to have to do something more substantive than just appoint a blue ribbon panel and make a few changes. He's going to have to bring in a real reformer to lead this department, someone who's going to be able to have the authority to make changes and buck up against the Fraternal Order of Police, who, you know, I would agree that the vast majority of police officers in Chicago are trying to do a good job. They're working hard. They're not racist. But there is an element that does things like Officer Van Dyke did and that are a blot on the city. And he's going to have to bring in someone that can really clean it up, change a culture that's existed for decades, going back to the John Burge era in the city of Chicago. He was a notorious police commander who has been proven to have tortured dozens of African-American people to extract confessions from them, many of them which were you know, outright lies. Mm-hmm. So there's just going to have to be a real change in culture. And if the mayor can't do that, he's going to continue to face this opposition and this protest. And he's just going to have to really make some sort of sea change, not just react to events, not wait till a judge orders a videotape released to take action.
Malcolm London, we just got half a minute here. You're an activist, but you're a poet as well. What's the deep truth here? What are we looking at, Malcolm?
I mean, I think we're looking at more people are starting to realize that we really have to be crucial about how we are imagining safety. And sometimes that doesn't always come from police. And police, in my opinion, often enact some of the violence that we see too often.
Malcolm London, from Chicago today, poet and activist there. Malcolm, come back soon. Thank you for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Hal Dardick, reporter for the Chicago Tribune, covering all this. Hal, we will follow your reporting, and we're grateful for your time today.
It was my pleasure being here.
On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jupp, Eileen Mata, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, James Ross, and Abby Ruzica, with help from Fatima Tanis and Dave Tarantino. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thank you for joining us. This is On Point.